south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. Okay, now, for all you listeners out there who are interested in the cost of medical care down here in Latin America, so unless you're at Trust Fund Baby or Mr. and Mrs. Moneybags, you will want to hear this. Especially since so many older expats are coming down, which means more health problems, right? Senior citizens, huh? Yuck. I'm getting to hate that term, aren't you? Anyway, it's true that when you come down here to Latin America, Medicaid and Medicaid will not cover you. How could they? Why would they? In fact, I just got a slew of emails and a couple of voicemails on my expatwisdom.com website on that very subject. Oh, and by the way, if you don't want to write an email and you feel like speaking your mind, you can go to expatwisdom.com and send me a voicemail. I think that voicemail option on expatwisdom.com started a month or so ago, so if you feel like it, just send me a voicemail. But easy on the four-letter words. I'm sensitive, you know. Anyway, like I said, I got a slew of emails and a couple of voicemails talking about Medicare and Medicaid and how, since it's not going to be covered if they come down here to Latin America, how the heck they're supposed to afford first-world medical care. Now, I'm beginning to think people who send me messages like that don't really believe how cheap first world healthcare is down here. And even if they come down and try to check it out for themselves, most of the time they won't be able to navigate their way around hospitals and doctors, etc., unless they can speak good Spanish. So you get a lot of newbie expats down here that go to the gringo expat bars looking for information on various things. Why? Because drunk and tipsy gringos are generally blabbermouths. And they're glad to tell you about things like lawyers, housing, and healthcare. Things they don't know too much about and usually pay gringo prices for. Why? Because they fail to learn even basic Spanish. Well, wait a minute, you say. Johnny says that it's often a trial to find good first world healthcare down here if you don't speak Spanish. But he also said a few shows back, most good first world style doctors speak English. So then that's definitely a contradiction, right? Johnny must be losing it. What up with that? Well, it's like this. Nearly all young modern Latin doctors speak English. That's 100% true. However, when you walk into their offices, especially off the gringo tourist trail, where you really get first world work at rock bottom prices, the problem there is their receptionists, nurses, and techs probably won't speak a lick of English. They'll just know the usual 20 English words that all people off the gringo tourist trail know, beginning with, nice to meet you. And by the way, a long, long time ago, when I first came down to Latin America, being well off the tourist trail and not knowing a lick of Spanish myself, when I heard someone say those magic words in English, nice to meet you, I always felt so relieved. Only to find out later, they answered all my many English questions with those magic words, nice to meet you. So, in medical facilities off the gringo tourist trail, as far as speaking English, the doctor surely will, but the nurses and the receptionists and the techs won't. So if you don't speak Spanish, here's how you approach that. You walk into a doctor's office or hospital clinic, whatever, and if the receptionist or whoever doesn't speak English, ask for the nearest doctor. He'll speak English. And unlike first world doctors who almost never have extra time to talk to you and they're running on high stress levels and 5-minute time segments and all that, Latin American doctors will stop what they're doing and come over and have a nice little conversation with you. Especially if you're a gringo. That's part of your gringo advantage. Even if you're not their patient, even if when you first walked in, they don't know you from Adam. And this is especially true off the gringo tourist trail because the doctor will finally have a chance to speak English with a real first world gringo. Because remember, off the gringo tourist trail, doctors do not have gringo patients. Simply because most of us are in Costa Rica, Panama, and Mexico. Like I said, take a walk in any big city in Latin America off the gringo tourist trail, and you probably won't see a single gringo all day. That is, unless you're in the first world hotel or embassy district. But those places don't count, and I advise you to keep away from them anyway. Now, oddly enough, even if you think you spot a gringo or two in a parking lot or across the street, Just mosey on over and listen to what kind of conversation that person is having, and you'll find 99.9% of the time, they're dyed-in-the-wool Latin Americans with a lot of European blood. Their Spanish is flawless, of course, because they were born here. So at first glance, they look like gringos or Europeans. Now, strangely enough, because of the class system down here, almost all of those Latins that look like gringos are upper middle class or wealthy. So naturally, they're more educated than the average Latin, so they speak a little English. And it's usually very broken. So if you walk up to one of these guys and gals, they're usually glad to talk to someone from the first world, too, in English. But anyway, in response to those emails and voicemails about so-called senior citizens that might want to come down here as expats, worried that once down here they'll be cut off from Medicaid and Medicare, I'd just like to read a little quarter-page ad I picked out of one of the big Sunday newspapers in El Salvador. The headline on this ad says, and I'll translate this, "First world laparoscopic surgical techniques that leave no scars are available for certain elective procedures." It's an ad for a first world style hospital medical complex, and they're advertising what they call Surgeria Mini, which means mini surgery. So they're talking about state-of-the-art laparoscopic surgeries with openings of only 3 millimeters, much less than an eighth of an inch. And here's what it says. "Get your elective surgery done without cicatrices," those are scars, "at our main hospital location." It says the following surgeries apply to this kind of technique: appendicitis, hernia, gastric reflux, kidney stones, ovarian cysts, gallbladder surgery, obesity surgery, and more. And then it goes on to list the costs of some of these surgeries. Get this. It says appendix surgery, appendectomy, via the mini laparoscopic technique, $1,800 complete. That includes your preliminary appointment with a specialist, and it includes all hospital costs, all medicine at the hospital, and all doctor's fees, including follow-up visits. That's a complete price, $1,800 US. Whereas in the U.S., the average cost for a laparoscopic appendectomy is $12,000. Do the numbers, folks. We're talking about 15% of the first world costs for the same operation. And remember, down here, in this case and many cases, we're talking about a complete package, a one-cost deal. Whereas up in the States, who knows what kind of additional cost they might pile on when you finally get your bill. All right, so let me go on to another one. In this same ad, it states, "The cost of mini surgery on the gallbladder or for a hernia, the complete package again, including the hospital charges, medicines, previous and follow-up appointments with a specialist, and all medical doctor fees, the package deal, $2,000. So then, what would your average hernia operation cost up in the first world? The cost, $12,000 to $15,000. Again, we're looking at Latin American costs to be around 15% of U.S. costs. Even much less in some cases, depending on how many add-on charges there are up in the first world when you get that thing done. Now, I know seeing is believing, and these prices are not out of the ordinary for Latin America. They're actually pretty standard. So, for all you doubting Thomases out there, I'll scan this very current little blurb here and send it to you. But remember, it's in Spanish. Though, since medical terms are similar in Spanish and English, you'll be able to get most of the drift. So, if you want a copy, just send me an email. TheExpatFiles@gmail.com or Johnny@expatwisdom.com, and I'll shoot it off to you. That said, just remember about half of the expats that come down here to Latin America pick up some kind of medical insurance that generally pay 80% with a 20% copay. And yes, I've seen some fantastic plans that run $50 or $60 a month for full HMO coverage. However, for those expats who just can't get on a plan, for example, many of these healthcare plans have a cutoff enrollment age limit of from 59 to 65 years old. But once you're on, generally these plans will cover you to age 99, as long as you keep paying the premium. Oh, and by the way, one of the insurance brokers down here told me that when people first sign up for the plan, these companies and agents almost always insist on a credit card or bank automatic withdrawal monthly. Because, like he said, unfortunately, Latins are so negligent in paying their premiums on time that when there is a crisis and they have to use a clinic or a doctor or a hospital, many times they find out, unfortunately, that they're not covered because they missed a payment. And he said that usually happens while you're sitting in the hospital emergency room. So, then what? That's why so many insurance companies won't even let you sign up unless you do the automatic credit card or bank withdrawal thing. Anyway, just note that if you're 59 or older, it'll be difficult to sign up for an insurance plan. Now, if you're under 59 and you come down here with some big-time pre-existing medical conditions, like a previous heart attack, then naturally you'll have trouble getting on a plan too. Or, for example, if you come down here as an expat and you're an injectable diabetic, then you're kind of stuck. I know, bad pun, huh? And most likely won't be able to pick up any local insurance. Then everything will be out of pocket. But like one long-term expat told me, he's an overweight, long-time diabetic with many vascular complications, and he says for what he pays with his out-of-pocket costs down here, for his medicines and syringes and doctor's appointments and all that, on a yearly basis. He tells me now he was worried too when he first came down, but what he pays wouldn't even cover the deductible, much less the premium, for the insurance that his younger brother has up in Texas. Not to mention he says his brother's premium is about $7,000 a year. So what my friend, this injectable diabetic down here in Latin America, does is he just puts $2,000 a year into what he calls his little medical savings account, and he uses that for his out-of-pocket expenses. And he says he's been doing that for 5 years now, and he's still got $6,000 in there. So it's building up for that big-time rainy day, I guess. He laughs and says that $6,000's good for a stroke or two. So this expat, in his late 50s, overweight, injectable diabetic with circulatory problems, bad U.S.-style diet, of course. He hasn't got religion on that yet. You know, drinks about a half a gallon of Diet Mountain Dew every day. Yep, they've got that crap down here, too. Courtesy of Walmart and Costco, of course. Anyway, he says in the past 5 years, with all his pharmacy supplies, etc., and medicines, doctor's visits, too, he's shelled out only about $4,000, which is $800 a year. Remember, this is a guy who's going raw. No insurance at all. He's paying out of his pocket. So there's a perfect case in point. You know, last I saw him, he was doing pretty good, but he knows things are going to get worse. I said, if they do, you just go back to Texas. There's always Obamacare. Then he just stared at me for a second and gave me a look like the Joker on Batman and laughed and laughed and laughed. He said, I'll give up meat, cheese, ice cream, even God, before I become a slave to that system again. Then I said, well, what about your brother? And he said, him, he's thick as a brick. He's nothing but a slave living in an electronic prison and he doesn't even know it. Okay, that said, let's move on. If you remember, a couple of shows ago, we were talking about the gross federal debt per person in the U.S., which is somewhere around $59,000 a person, versus the average gross national debt per person in Latin American countries, with a few countries up there around $5,000 or $6,000 per person and most around $1,000 per person. And after that show aired, I got a few emails, including this one from Gary. He says, Johnny, about that public debt thing you were talking about, you know, you have to compare the average salary per month or year in that country and go beyond just the numbers. For example, in the USA, what's the average worker's salary? Something like 30 to 40K per year versus Central America, which is around 3,600. So it's about the same ratio, 1.5 to 2 years to pay off their share of the individual's country debt for both. So then let me stop here and address that. Now, Gary, this just proves that statistics can be manipulated any way you want them. You've got some good arguments there, but I'm going to blow a hole in them. First of all, you're saying that your conclusion is, both up there in the States and down here, a person's fractional share of his country's national debt is about the same. You're saying it's 1.5 to 2 times a person's annual income. But you know, using a person's average income is like apples and oranges when you compare the U.S. to Latin America. Why? The average household income in the U.S. is about $50,000 a year. And the average household in the U.S. has 2.6 persons, meaning that breaks down to $19,000 per each member of the family. So in the U.S., by that standard, it would take 3 years for each person to pay down his portion of the national debt, around $59,000. Whereas in Latin America, although the average working person makes about $350 a month, the average household income is about double that, about $700 a month. That's because everyone in the family, even mom and the kids, contribute to the household income or else they wouldn't be able to make ends meet, since what they call the canasta básica down here The average monthly amount needed to pay for everything you needed that month, food, water, electricity, transportation, etc., runs about $700 a month. Now, since the average Latin household has four members in it, that means the average yearly income generated per person is $2,100. And with the average national debt of most Latin countries hovering at around $1,000 per person, that means the average person could pay off his portion of the national debt in a half a year. Whereas, if you're living in the U.S., it would take you six times as long to pay off your portion of the national debt, about 3 years. Even when you balance it against personal or household income, the average American is six times more indebted to the state than the average Latin American is to his. Now, of course, there are a half a dozen other ways to make sense of this, but any way you add it up, United States citizens are in a huge debt hole they'll never be able to get out of. Confucius say, when hole too deep, throw away a shovel, but that ain't gonna happen. Or as a very famous carpenter once said, no matter how many times I cut this board, it's still too short. And if you're guessing right now that carpenter was Karen or Jesus, nope, it was Curly Howard. And note, when you throw in Argentina, Chile, and Mexico, countries that have a much higher national debt per capita ratio, don't forget that those countries have much higher average wages than most of the rest of Latin America, too. For example, the average wage in Colombia is around $700 a month, double that of most of the other Latin countries. And the country has more than double the average Latin per capita country debt. And by the way, speaking of Colombia, people are always asking what the state of Colombia is today. Is it a good place to work, play, live, retire, and or hang out? Well, I can tell you that unfortunately it's getting a lot of traction lately in retirement rags and international living. Because of that, the gringos and Europeans aren't trickling in like they used to. They're kind of opening up the tap and flooding in, especially to the big cities like Medellin, Cali, and Bogota. So unfortunately, in the last year and a half or so, prices have been jacking up. In fact, in many places, prices are at or near first world levels. Now, when you're out in the boonies, out in the countryside, things are a bit different. You still can get very low prices on local produce, etc. However, the thing that bothers me most about Colombia is that they've got seven, count them, seven U.S. military bases. So, if you're like me, you want to stay as far away as possible from that kind of U.S. influence. So, then, as far as avoiding the tentacles of U.S. Big Brother, personally, I'd visit, but I wouldn't want to live in Colombia, Costa Rica, Panama, Chile, or Mexico. Simply because there are just too many gringos and way too much U.S. influence altogether. Now, that's not to say the U.S. hasn't got its Big Brother foot in the door all over the place in Latin America. For example, until recently, the U.S. has operated 22 U.S. military bases in Latin America, a total of 800 worldwide. Now there are two more, one in Chile and one in Argentina. So all of you who are thinking how nice and calm and democratic Chile is, here's something else that scares me so much I'd never want to move to Chile. Listen to this. It's something that's been kept pretty much out of the press, and most Chileans don't even know about it. Let me paraphrase this article. Chilean defense officials and U.S. Southern Command signed an agreement to allow U.S. troops to be deployed in Chile whenever, quote, the Chilean army finds itself overwhelmed by some emergency situation. For example, natural disasters or any other such calamities, or when international aid with military components are required, or when, quote, national emergency scenarios prompt a state of exception and suspension of constitutional guarantees. Whoa, the long tentacles of Big Brother, huh? And you know, Chile's one of the few countries in Latin America that has a decent enough infrastructure to organize first world Big Brother crap like that. Now, you tell me what you think about this. Did you know that in the last 6 years, the U.S. government has funneled over $45 million in military and police aid to Chile? And here, all along, we thought little Chile was so laid back, unpretentious, and unassuming, didn't we? So then what did your $45 million buy in Chile? Well, here's the list. Joint military exercises, troop exchanges, Chilean participation in U.S. National Guard training. And this is key. Did you know that little Chile has spent almost $1 billion over the last 20 years purchasing U.S. military equipment. Tit for tat, huh? And scariest of all, in that 20 years, Chile has sent 4,000 soldiers to the U.S. Army's School of the Americas. You might remember that long-standing school of terrorism in Panama. Well, you know, it had such a rotten reputation, they actually changed the name. Now it's called Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. Like that, huh? Oh, and I saved the best for last. What do you think of this? 90 miles northwest of the capital of Chile, Santiago, there's a base funded by the U.S. military's Southern Command, authorized under the Obama regime, where there's a large 8-building complex that's used specifically as a training prop for mock urban battles. Yep, mock urban battles. Now, what's that all about? Just what it says. Mock urban battles, just in case, huh? So, is there something we should be feeling good about here? You wannabes and gonna-bes thinking about going to Chile, are you feeling safer now? I guess the only good news about that is the fact that in the next year or two, smart people in the know anyway, believe there's going to be such a huge crack in the economic fabric up in the United States, as well as Europe and the rest of the first world, that Big Brother just won't have the time, the money, or the personnel to put the clamps down within its own borders and crack the whip in Latin America, too. So Chile, skip it. But where was I? Oh, yeah. We were talking about Gary's earlier email, the one about the indebtedness of everyone to his country's national debt. Anyway, after finishing up on that subject, he ends up changing gears and talking about strawberries, of all things. And I know why, because in a recent past show, I talked about going to one of those gigantic produce markets where, when off the gringo tourist trail, you could get huge strawberries for 40 cents a pound. So, referring back to that, Gary asks, are the strawberries organic? To be organic or not to be organic? That is Gary's question. Well, there's certified organic with a label or a sticker. Then you can be 99% sure. Then there's so-called organic because the guy who's selling it to you says it is. You did know, of course, that the term organic just means a compound with carbon atoms in it, right? You'd know that if you ever took organic chemistry. So then these days, the term organic has been all perverted, since anything that's alive and grows at all is technically organic. That said, to get produce certified with stickers and tags, etc., the grower really has to jump through a lot of hoops. Well, first of all, you have to comply with USDA organic standards. And get this, each processing plant and each company that handles your product before it's packaged must complete its own organic system plan, whatever that is. Then you must submit your organic system plan to your certifying official agent and prepare to be visited by that agent for site inspections. On top of that, it costs money to get certified. Organic certification runs around $1,500. Initial application fee, $275. Site inspection fee, materials, etc., $500. Expedited certification fee, $1,475. An annual certification fee based on the gross organic production value, usually between $400 and $1,500 for a small farm or small processor. As you can tell, I just read that from a document. And then it goes on to say, after your site inspection is complete, the USDA approval process may take anywhere from 6 to 10 weeks. Oh, and just as an aside here, I know someone that was looking into setting up an organic coconut plantation. And he told me that in some cases it takes from 2 to 4 years from the time you plant your trees and harvest the first crop. The same with cacao, that's chocolate, pecan, macadamia, and avocado. And he said he gave up on it when he heard about all that red tape. Anyway, I guarantee you that when you come down here to Latin America and you go to one of these big central markets, you won't see one single label that says certified organic because most of that produce coming in daily and arriving at those hundreds of little kiosks comes from small local truck farms or people that own tiny plots of land. Now, believe me, when you go to these markets and you see who's selling this produce, you'll realize in a second that most of these people are just scraping by and that 99.9% of them don't even know what organic or organic labeling even means. Sure, you can go into some of these nicer neighborhoods and find various cloned versions of Whole Foods, etc., where they actually stock certified organic products on their shelves, mostly imported. And you can go to Costco or Walmart, and they'll have some of the usual suspects that say certified organic on them, too. And for that, of course, like in the States, you'll probably pay double or triple the price that the farmer would charge if you got it direct from him or at one of his little kiosks in the central market. So then, what about those 40 cents a pound gigantic strawberries? In fact, what about all that great produce you see in these gigantic markets? Well, I'm sure that a lot of it's not exactly organic. Probably half of the stuff there has had some nitrogen-based fertilizer thrown on it. And I know for a fact that some of the fruits have been sprayed with some kind of insecticide because they certainly sell bags of it at farmers' co-ops, etc. But also, I'd say about half of the produce is truly organic. It's just not labeled. However, not only is there almost no demand for it, not to mention 99% of Latins don't know what the hell it is anyway. And finally, because most of these guys and gals are living on the edge, there's just no way that a small truck farmer is gonna dish out that kind of money to get a special label like that. So if you really are a stickler about pure, unadulterated, organic, you can either go to the Whole Foods clone or Costco or Walmart and pay too much, or go to one of these big central markets, whatever, and ask the seller what kind of fertilizer they use and if they spray the crop. They won't lie to you. Since, like I said, most people are totally ignorant about what organic is and wouldn't give a damn anyway. So bottom line, if you're not sure, just ask. And by the way, down here they call fertilizer abono. That's A-B-O-N-O. You know, like there's abono in U2. Or for that matter, Cher's dead ex-husband, Sonny, who was also abono. So then, with just a little bit of Spanish, you could ask the person who's selling the strawberries if they use abono natural, which is natural fertilizer like chicken shit, which you can buy in 50 and 100-pound sacks in almost all agricultural supply stores. And if they say they're not using abono natural, they're probably using that pelletized nitrogen fertilizer. That's the stuff that politicians give away about a week before voting time. And as far as spraying insecticides, just ask who's ever selling the stuff if they spray con insecticida. Spray in Spanish is spray, nearly the same. And insecticide, insecticida. How hard is that? Oh, and one last thing. Don't forget about my July 2015 Expat Wisdom Seminar in Central America. You won't want to miss this one. Just go to expatwisdom.com and on the main page, you'll see a link that says Latin American Seminar. Click on that for full details. Sign up before May 1st because that's when the price goes up $500 per person. So do get in on the early bird discount.
South of the border, down Mexico way.
You've been listening to the Expat Files, living in Latin America, coming to you twice a week from somewhere south of the border. Email me, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out expatwisdom.com to sign up for your free reports on Latin America. See you next time. Nos vemos. She was a picture in old style.